Previously on Popping Collars.
Yeah, I go to the UK a lot. You can bet on anything, anytime, and you walk down the street, there's the equivalent of like the 7-Eleven of gambling. You could just stroll in there, place your bets on a little, you know, on a kiosk and get your slip and then just go to the table. I mean, then when...
The royal baby's name!
Right? Bet on the queen's corgis. Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection between religion and pop culture. I am your host. My name is Greg Knight. I am in Palm Beach, Florida, and with me are my co-hosts, Betsy Gonzalez from Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Betsy.
Hey, Gregory.
Liz Easton from Omaha, Nebraska. Hello,
hey,
Liz.
Greg.
And our special guest back with us again from Brookline, Massachusetts, Richard Burden. Hi, Richard.
Hey, Greg.
This is episode 28 of the 1,193rd ranked podcast in the iTunes spirituality category. We've moved up 200 spots since the first time.
Woohoo!
Huge!
Our topic today is Jessica Jones. Coming off the heels of the excellent Daredevil series, Netflix is going back to the Marvel Comics well with another street-level hero, this time with Jessica Jones, a private detective with super strength, who suffers from trauma experienced at the hands of the Purple Man, Zebediah Kilgrave. So, just general thoughts on the show. Good? Bad? Somewhere in between? What's your initial takeaway?
Well, I'll say this is, believe it or not, this is my first superhero television show, movie, media of any kind. I don't know anything about the Marvel cosmos. No, I had to go to, like, Marvel Wiki today to figure out, like, who is this Purple Man, and how did Jessica Jones get this super strength? So this is totally my first superhero, and I love it, and I like it because there's no, like, capes or costumes that I've
try a costume.
Mm-hmm. Fail. Epic fail.
Well, you know, in terms of costuming, let's talk about, I mean, it's boots, jeans,
love
tank top,
it.
Couple of hoodies, some layers, right?
Big ol' scarf.
Big scarf sometimes, right? Sunglasses sometimes. And just super, you know, bitch face look. Like, she is, I love Kristen Ritter. I think this is a role that was made for her. And just amazing at what she does to kind of embody the role and just kind of own it and give it a lot of soul and backstory. You know, that I'm interested now to dig around and kind of what's going on. And I like superhero stories. I like flawed, damaged people who are trying to do good things, because it's all feels like an exaggeration of who we are, you know, that we're all flawed and hurt people who I would at least hope are, as you know, people of goodwill, as Bishop Curry likes to say, people of goodwill everywhere, you know, that we're all trying to do that. But I've really enjoyed it so far. I'm about six in. Liz, you're about seven in. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
So the boys have seen them all, but we're a little behind.
I think that what makes this show, and it's interesting, like, because it is part of this whole superhero mythos, but I think that if you were to just watch it independent of the Avengers, Iron Man, Captain America, Daredevil, any of the Marvel stuff that's come before, it actually really stands apart. And I think the reason that it stands apart is because the stakes are way different in Jessica Jones than they are in the rest of the Marvel movies. Like, everything else in comics is always grander. Like, how can we make it bigger? You know, the world is threatened. Guardians of the Galaxy, the universe is threatened. You know, it's just raising the stakes exponentially over and over and over again. And the thing that's really different about Jessica Jones, and I think what makes it really appealing, is the stakes are her life and her friends' lives. That's what Kilgrave wants to damage, is her. He doesn't care about the world. He doesn't care about taking over New York City. He doesn't care about anything. He just wants to damage her, one person. And I think that that separates it from the rest of the Marvel Universe, but it also makes it really terrifying, especially as you get towards the later episodes where she has to confront this trauma that he keeps making her experience over and over again.
Richard, what's your impression? What do you think?
I agree with Greg, and I'm such a sucker for like hard-boiled detective sort of stuff, and the fact that this is sort of Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, this kind of really gritty detective story that has some superhero stuff sort of layered into it. I just thought it was really interesting. And like you, Betsy, this idea that these are flawed people, really, really kind of broken people trying to do the best they can and not always succeeding in the best way or not even succeeding at all. It's the fact that it's a couple of very strong female characters and it's told from that point of view, I thought was really refreshing. In the superhero world is so kind of male dominated. We've got, you know, there's a ton of Bruce Waynes and Peter Parkers who are, you know, troubled, dark, brooding men, but we don't often get a lot of depth out of the female characters in the superhero world.
You know, when you brought up her costume choice, which is basically just street clothes, right? I think that kind of speaks volumes because, you know, women in female characters in comics don't always get the greatest kind of costume choices. It's usually as thin as possible and as tight as possible.
A lot of spandex.
And so to see a woman who's a woman, you know, who's not Black Widow, right? Who's not sort of Scarlett Johansson. Again, it's a different approach from Marvel. And I think that it makes it stand out and it makes you kind of pay attention. Like, what's going on here? Like, why is this so different? And what is it about its difference that makes it appealing, I think?
Yeah.
Well, and not afraid to play around with, you know, gender roles and interracial relationships and gay-straight relationships. I mean, just I like how they're just kind of going for it. And I also like the detective part, too. But what I appreciate is, like, when I told my husband I was liking the show, he said, well, it's not like one of those shows where, like, every episode she's having to solve a crime, and then they dribble in a little bit of backstory, or they dribble in, you know, there's a momentum to the main theme in the story, and I like that they're not kind of just giving me a little amuse-bouche every week of the backstory. They're giving you a lot, and I appreciate that.
The protagonist is Jessica Jones, who has super strength, and the antagonist, who's the Purple Man, Zebediah Kilgrave, who can control people's minds. So it's a diametrically opposed power set. One has the ability to punch you and beat you up, and the other one has the ability to control your mind. And the way that interplay kind of works is that Kilgrave was able to control Jessica Jones at one point, and now he's trying to figure out how to control her again. He can control everyone else except her. And so he's become kind of obsessed with her and being able to control her, and that becomes a metaphor in the show for being stuck in abusive relationships, right? Falling into abusive cycles and abusive patterns, and how do you overcome that cycle, and how do you free yourself from that cycle?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most interesting elements of the show is how compellingly and sympathetically, I guess, they paint that picture of what it's like to be manipulated by a masterful abuser, you know, that she, even though she's like the strongest woman in the world, she's still terrified of this man who was able to control her in ways that she didn't expect and didn't know how to get out of, but still was also aware of. I think that's sort of the sinister way that he controls his victims is they know that they're under his spell. They're aware of that even when they're doing these things that they can't imagine doing. And then even when she finally frees herself of him, like in the first episode when she realizes that he's back, her first impulse is to run away. She's terrified. Even when you're a person who is physically pretty invulnerable, you can still have this terror over you by an abusive partner.
Well, that's what I thought was really fascinating about it was, you know, the main thrust of Kilgrave is this sort of mind control. But then as the whole story sort of unfolds, it becomes apparent that everybody is controlling or trying to control someone else at some level. Trish's mom, there's this whole backstory about the kind of control that is implied of, you know, her. And there's the lawyer, the Carrie Ann Moss character, who's sort of, you know, who's doing, you know, jury manipulation and is involved in horrible divorce proceedings. And there's all kinds of that everybody's involved in this sort of subtle control of other people in sometimes passive aggressive ways and sometimes aggressive aggressive ways. And it, you know, at some point I started thinking, wow, you know, Kilgrave is just sort of the distillation of all of this, but it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm. I find the mind control just terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. I mean, the ability for him to like take over people's apartments and mm-hmm. people's lives. It's that, those times when they were trying to figure out who actually had experience with him and who didn't, with kind of the, you know, testimony of people. And, you know, when he just walks into people's apartments and just, you know, the kids go in the closet and, you know, I'm just going to have a meal and, you know, or leave your kid on the side of the road and you're going to drive me around for 3 days. You know, it's like, that is utterly terrifying. And I think it kept making me think about free will. I actually just got this question. We just sometimes do chaplain on a hot seat. So the kids submit, here at school, submit questions for the chaplains, and we put them in an empty Twizzlers box and we draw questions out in front of everybody instead of a sermon. That's what we do. We do questions, random questions, and it's terrifying as well. But, I got the question of, you know, do you think that God controls all of our life or are things what we make of them? And so that whole idea of, you know, because some people would use the phrase that Kilgrave is playing God, right? That he is in control of everything. You go walk off the building and you go do this and that kind of thing. And I think that element of how flawed that system actually is and what a gift that ability for free will is. And I hadn't thought about, Liz, what you were saying, that those moments when she confronts people being controlled and they know they're being controlled. Mm-hmm. And that is just a killer. That's just a killer. So it's, I think that element of the importance of human beings and free will and how we can screw up and how we can make good choices and how we can make bad choices, and to have that, have yourself robbed of that to serve the means of another. I think oftentimes people think that's what religion is. They think that there's an element of that, that that's what God wants, you know, mm-hmm. that we submit and then you just become something else. And there's some little book that has day planner that has your life in it. And this is what's going to happen. And then you're going to mic drop on this day and it's over, you know. But I think this made me wrestle around with some of those ideas.
Yeah, because if that were true, I wouldn't worship that God. You know, if God had mind control over my life, I would be like, God, what are you doing? Like what? You know, like, I am too broken and sinful a person to worship that God. I could see why if people really thought that that's what was going on, it would be a horrifying sale, I guess, for religion. I wouldn't buy it.
It would be God who would be making you horrible.
Right,
sinful,
I know.
Right?
Right.
So, yeah, what's that all about?
Yeah.
What a rigged game.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. A couple of times in the show, she refers to him as the devil pretty clearly. And there is, you know, as a personification of evil, I think that that's a pretty compelling story, you know, of Kilgrave. Now, I don't think that the devil works that way either, but I can see why that would be the metaphor that you would use.
Well, he also doesn't have to have any powers of persuasion.
Right.
You know, he is the charming, he's a former Doctor Who, right? Yeah. Okay. That, you know,
he's the 10th Doctor.
Right, he's very charming in his own right, but he doesn't really have to be charming. You know, he's having the accent, the whole thing, the clothes, you know, but he doesn't really have to be charming. There's no temptation. You know, it's just doing.
Can we talk about Luke Cage? Because I'm a big Luke Cage guy.
Yeah, well,
so Luke Cage is very important to the Jessica Jones comics, because ultimately they end up getting married, they have kids, they have a whole sort of superhero family.
Oh,
but
what?
Spoilers!
Okay.
They're like the Incredibles.
They are like the Incredibles.
Oh my God, that baby, it would like
be beautiful.
Like, well, it would injure her from the inside. What would it do? Oh my God!
They're two very attractive people.
So she's trying to atone for a sin that she's done, or a wrong that she's kind of done to Luke. And the way that it kind of manifests itself in, gosh, what is it, episode 2 or 3 when they get together? It results in them just going at it as much as possible. He is like alcohol to her. He is like cigarettes to her. He's just another kind of addiction for her to use. She is damaged. She is a drinker, right? She is someone who just kind of feels like she's trying to hurt herself. And it kind of feels like she's trying to use Luke that way early on, and Luke won't let her do it. Like, we talk about this world of superheroes and, like, super strength and all that stuff. There's something heroic about someone trying to make you something for them and saying no to that, right? And I think that that's Luke's heroism in that moment somehow.
And I didn't get that sense of what you just described, Greg, in the show as much. I got the sense more that, you know, she was, I guess, playing with confronting this thing that she felt super shameful about and getting as close to it as she possibly could by getting close to him. But then also this purely physical wonder of being able to be with someone as strong as you are, you know, and sort of enjoying that and throwing yourself into that. And then the sex scenes themselves, which I think point to this being written and directed by women, the sex scenes themselves felt really, I guess, egalitarian, to use some word, is they, you know, they were really equal in their pleasure and their direction of all of that. It's just, it was, they were the types of sex scenes that you don't really see on TV that much.
There sometimes you run into those relationships. Usually it's when you're younger, where you're like, you know, I don't know if this is going to lead to anything, but for right now, this is all I need. And that's the feeling that I kind of got from the relationship early between her and Luke, is that I don't need this to be anything. I just need this to be whatever I need it to be right now.
Well, because he's so, you know, surprisingly sensitive. It's this great opposites in him of like this incredible physical strength and then this really emotional sensitivity, and how deeply he feels betrayed by her when he finds out what really happened. You know, he couldn't fathom that she would allow herself, I'm sorry, that she would, you know, allow him to be intimate with her when she had done this incredible betrayal. I think he's just a great character. He's one of my favorite characters on the show.
Think about a show like Girls, or any sort of way that kind of female power and feminism and those sorts of things are being talked about. I find the conflict inside her to be very on point. So, you know, I can drink as much as I want. I can screw who I want. I can do what I want because it's my sexuality. It's my body. It's who I am. And I can make all the choices for myself, and that sometimes that gets marketed and employed by young women in a very detached kind of way. You know, I can do all of this for pleasure and enjoy it all I want to, but I don't necessarily have to have a connection to it. But then she has the battle inside her that Kilgrave knows. Her weaknesses is that she gives a damn. Her weaknesses is that she cares. And that's one of the reasons why she can't, when she walks away from Luke, before he even knows what's the truth is, because she just can't do it. She can't keep doing that and not feel the guilt or her own shame or whatever that is. And that she has that conflict happening inside her, and kind of what modern feminism, the different ways that people try to put portraits out there of it, that she is a conflicted person inside that.
Right. Right. I mean, it's this huge error in popular conceptions of modern feminism that women are empowered by having sex like men when men are not at their best. You know what I mean? Like, this idea, like this Tinder culture is somehow empowering for women, is just insane. And I think that you see that. I mean, I like Girls. I like Lena Dunham. I think that she's also.
Oh, me too.
You know,
oh, no. And I wasn't bringing that up negatively.
Right. But this idea that, you know, whatever, I do what I want, like that is right. Good and empowering for women sexually. For some women, certainly. But it's not the whole picture. But part of what's so fun about this show is the incredible fantasy of being that physically strong. That in a lot of places and spaces in our culture, women are physically vulnerable. And we need to be aware of, like, where the exit is and how dark the alley is and what shoes we're wearing and what we're carrying and all of that, even in subtle ways. I mean, it's not like it's haunting me all the time, but it's stuff that I'm aware of. And this idea that physically you could be so strong that nobody could mess with you is just a wonderful fantasy to have. Like, that's one less thing to worry about. That would be great.
And yet she still gets messed with.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm trying to be very careful about not giving spoilers away, but you know, something Liz said about, you know, women not being with men when they're not at their best. It's sort of in the later episodes when Kilgrave gets into this space of he can't control her, so he wants her to want it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this very interesting, it's horribly manipulative, but kind of fascinating several scenes where he goes through this whole being really as good as he can be, right? In order to make her, in order to manipulate her in a different way. But it's sort of he's being good, you know.
I will say this, the show makes it explicit at one point, and this is a spoiler, but I think it's okay to talk about. The show makes it explicit at one point that he rapes her.
Yeah.
You know, they're having a conversation with each other, and he says, you know, you weren't always repulsed by me, right? Like, there were times when we were really close. I mean, we were really close. And she's like, yeah, that's rape, right? Like,
right.
You didn't allow me to have any control over what it was that I was doing. And the show gets into the subtext of that. Like, what does that mean? Like, how far does that manipulation go? And, you know, how much control did he actually have over her? And how much guilt is she carrying?
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that a lot, I mean, I don't want to pretend to speak for survivors of abuse, but I think that idea of your agency being reduced, you know, so much, and then the shame that you carry around for that is a huge part of recovering from that trauma. You know, we're not supposed to not be in control of our own lives. And yet there are some circumstances and some people that really does happen. And mm-hmm. It's so hard for people, men and women both, who are in those relationships to reach out for help because of the shame of, like, why can't I extricate myself from this? Where did my agency go?
Yeah. Yeah, we talk about it a lot, working in boarding school world surrounded by a bunch of teenagers who, when you talk about agency and feeling manipulated and shame and, you know, all those sorts of things that can go into things, you know, and especially after things like, you know, the lawsuits and things in St. Paul's School in New Hampshire. I mean, you're often kind of talking about coercion and what does that look like and how much of do I actually want it, but I allow it to go too far? I want it. I want this person. So what will I do to allow that to happen? So there's a number that you do on yourself. There's a number that's being done exteriorly to you in terms of that amount of manipulation and shame.
Mm-hmm.
Which gets back to the whole question of how much control do any of us really have over our own lives and our own, you know, our own free will. I mean, we're constantly being pulled by various forces and by our own desires and what we have been told that we can and can't do and the limits that we perceive that we have. And it's just kind of an interesting thing to sort of meditate on and work on, is how much control do we really have?
There comes a moment, though, where you start to see her fear sort of escalate and escalate and escalate. It's when she finds out that Kilgrave is still alive. Liz, you pointed it out. And then she has, like, this extreme fear, and she has this, you know, moment of, do I walk away? Do I stay and fight? And she stays and fight, but she fights with fear. Like, she's never divorced. Like, she's never, like, and now I'm going to fight, and now I'm, you know, Rocky, super serious. I'm going to go in and beat up the Russian who killed Apollo Creed.
Right.
Like, she's never fully confident. She's shaken along the way. Even when she has Kilgrave at her mercy, she's still fearful about what could happen. And there's a moment where she has him trapped, dead to rights. She's got him in a cage. He can't go anywhere. And she's still afraid of what he's capable of. And I think that something about being a victim, especially being a victim of violence, using a little bit of my personal story here, but as a child, I had an abusive parent. And, you know, there's something about the relationship that that person has with you that, you know, if I were to see my father again, I would be an 8-year-old boy. Like, it doesn't matter who I am now. I would instantly revert back to who I was when I was a victim, right? And I think that she is able to kind of carry that in her character as the story progresses and as the stakes get a little bit higher and higher and higher as she's starting to confront, you know, what it is that she's going up against.
Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, a really powerful thing to see kind of on TV or like writ large, that our vulnerabilities and we can carry those with us as we're doing totally unexpected and, you know, things we never could have expected of ourselves. That doesn't mean that we put aside or turn away from our vulnerabilities, but they're right there alongside us. They're, you know, part mm-hmm. of it, part of the story. Well,
and I think it's exemplified in this show by the fact that those moments where she's like, it could be anything, anyone,
right.
anyone could be the person who's coming to kill me, could be the person who's coming to get me, in that way that anything can be a trigger for anybody suffering through a post-traumatic stress disorder, suffering through abuse and the fallout from that, just depression and other things that can affect you all along the course of your life. And what is going to be the trigger for that? It could be something very unrelated to actually viewing that person. You know, it's hearing a song or it's something, and then you're right back in it. You're right back in it. And, you know, with her, the color changes. Everything becomes those blues and pinks and just all kind of, and it actually echoes the drawing of the comic, you know, that those are the same colors that are really exemplified in the comic, which is interesting. So yeah, it could be in it.
And then the purple mm-hmm. gets more and more pronounced. Yeah. Kilgrave's suits become more and more purple until by second to last episode, he's in a nightclub surrounded by purple lights in a purple suit. He's got, you know, his skin is like, you know, purple tinted from the gels and stuff. I mean, he's become like this symbolic, you know, color of evil for her. And she has to stand in that space and confront him. Going pieces segment. This is traditionally where we would like used to plug our websites and our Twitter feeds and all that stuff, but people can get in touch with us pretty easily. So we've started talking about what are pieces of pop culture that we've been looking at, reading through, listening to in our lives that we can recommend to people. So I'm just going to go in order as you are on my screen. So Betsy, what's a piece that you would like to present to us tonight?
Oh, man.
Richard, what's a piece that you would like to let us know about?
So when I finished watching Jessica Jones, I switched over to Amazon and started watching Man in the High Castle. which had got great reviews, Philip K. Dick novel. The TV show was very good. I really enjoyed it and really wanted to read the book after that. So if you like your alternative history, or I should say if you like your history alternative.
Liz, what's a piece of pop culture that you would share with us?
Well, I think I shared this recently, but I also think you edited it out. So,
I'm sorry.
No, fine. It's a long book. I'm reading Purity by Jonathan Franzen, which I've been reading for a long time now. And I have this love-hate relationship with Jonathan Franzen ever since I read The Corrections when I was like in – maybe I was in high school, at the end of high school. I hate his characters. I hate them so much I want to throw the book on the ground. But I love his storytelling and his language and the way he constructs these characters is amazing. But I hate them. And he seems to maybe hate women. So it's been I recommend the book just because it's a total page-turner, and it has this great kind of Julian Assange-type character in it, and it's pretty good, except for the jury's still out about whether it's fundamentally misogynistic. I'll let you know.
Betsy, do you have a piece yet?
Piece of something, Greg?
Yeah, so often.
Well, before I shared that I was having a Ken Burns issue, all of a sudden, like out of nowhere, there's lots of Ken Burns going on for me. Until
Is there an ointment for that?
There's no known treatment for Ken Burns syndrome, is what I've heard.
Some aloe, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, I think 12 steps of getting past Ken Burns in your life might be good. But so I was watching the Civil War. until I got distracted by Jessica Jones. So now I'm kind of, well, I gotta get through Jessica Jones. I'm only halfway through. So I'm that's my current jam at the moment. So that then I can get back to the battlefield because Ulysses S. Grant is not in charge of the Union Army yet. When does this happen? So yeah, I just gotta get there.
I don't want to spoil the Civil War for you.
I'll let you
see how that plays out.
This whole episode, so I don't know what could happen.
So my piece is I just finished watching the season finale of The Leftovers right before we started recording this, and I had kind of a Walking Dead, like a love hate relationship with The Leftovers because it was so doggone depressing, but equally kind of compelling at the same time. And I thought that this season, the way that it wrapped up, I just thought it was lovely. It was violent and horrible in places, but at the end it made me roll a bit of a tear. And it had one of my favorite, most vulnerable renditions of Homeward Bound by Simon and Garfunkel that I've ever heard in my life in its entirety. They sang the entire song. You can find us on the web at poppingcollegepodcast.com, where you can listen to all of our shows. And please subscribe to us on iTunes, and maybe we'll move up another 200 spots on the spirituality ranking.
I mean, that's amazing.
And you can also find us at EpiscopalCafe.com, who features our show each and every time. We love Episcopal Cafe, and we hope that you'll check out their site and read their stories. So with that, that's Popping Collars for this time. Thank you, Betsy. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Liz, for coming on the show. We'll see you next time.
Keep those collars popped.